Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Let's close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. We didn't quite get that timing right.
I said it after you in the right order. We said our names.
But
it
we
wasn't
didn't
quite
say our names
together.
Quite synchronously. Whatever. One of those.
Synchronously? Is that a
word? I don't think that's the right word. I think there's a...
In synchrony? In sync?
In sync. Anyway, this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and it is the name of this radio program. It's also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, and that is not a coincidence, and it is a registered trademark name. It has a little circle R after it, although you can't hear it when we say it. If we said it correctly, we would say, The Personal Wealth Coach.
With a circled R?
Yeah.
Right.
The Personal Wealth Coach. And that way you'd know that it was a registered trademark.
Right.
So nobody else can use it except A, this radio program, and B, the firm that's in Salado. But since they're both the same thing, it's
sort
okay.
Of. Yeah.
And anything we say on here should not be considered to be investment advice, even though we are an investment advisory firm. We are the principals in an investment advisory firm because we're just educating. Investment advice is given to individuals based on their individual circumstances. And any information that we relate to you on this radio program is we get it from places we think are reliable and trustworthy and truthful, but we make no warranty or guarantee to that effect.
Right.
Yeah. Anything else you need to say? Close cover before striking.
Authorized personnel only beyond this point. Which
yes.
Point? Well, it's in the radio. So there's a point somewhere in the radio.
But it may not be actually in a radio.
Where is the point?
I don't know.
What is the point?
It's pointless. Which is the essence of this radio program.
Right.
And
pointless inanity about the economy.
And if today where you are is October 7th, then you're certainly welcome to give us a call in here at the Personal Wealth Coach at KTEM and ask any questions or make any comments or whatever you want to do as long as they don't have anything to do with – well, actually, you can talk about team sports all you want to. It's just we won't understand anything you're saying. And the telephone number is 254-773-1400.
Right. I'm going to make a sports prediction.
You are?
Yes. If – the Bulls win the Super Bowl this year, we will have a runaway market. That's my prediction. Try to disprove that.
I'm working, I saw some very good articles about Bulls in the market.
Right. The cover of The Economist. That was a big deal. I mean, we've got some things to say what happened this week, but the cover of The Economist had a bull on it.
Yeah, well, The Economist is not one of them that will trigger the market collapse. The problem is that Time magazine is dying.
Yeah, so it's really hard to use it as a pulse.
How are we going to know? Yeah, Time, Newsweek, or U.S. News and World Report have a bull on the cover. And if all three of them have a bull on the cover, then – and I don't even know if U.S. News and World Report still exists.
Yeah, the old saying was when they all have a bull on the cover, it's ready to – time to tighten your britches because the market's about to drop. In this case, we don't see a lot of bulls out there, and even the theme of the magazine, The Economist, which is out of the UK, so it's not an American publication.
IK?
UK, that is okay. Correct. Yes, IK, UK, who cares?
Okay.
Anyway, the whole idea is that if the bulls are out there, that and people are all saying, yes, we're in a bull market, then that means everybody is on board the bull, which means there isn't anybody yeah. left to buy. Because if you're on board, then you're already buying. And in the case of The Economist, the big chunk of the magazine was put up there saying, is this really a bull? What's going on? The story about the bull was the worry about whether or not the market's going to continue. So...
Well,
it's kind of counterintuitive because we look for euphoria and over-optimistic viewpoints. We're still not seeing it.
Euphoria.
Euphoria in the UK.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, let's see. During the week, the Dow Jones Industrial Average climbed 368.58 points, which sounds really impressive. That's 1.6%. And it closed out at 22,773.67. That's its fourth consecutive week of gains. The NASDAQ climbed 1.5% to 6590.18. That's a record high. While the Standard & Poor's 500 rose 1.2% to 2,549. What are you looking at?
A calendar. I'm not intending to interrupt you. Just go ahead.
Okay. It always scares me when you look past me like there's a monster over my left shoulder.
Yeah, there's a monster in a calendar.
Okay. So we are still – actually, the S&P 500 did not end the week at a record-breaking level because it dropped just a little bit on Friday. Thursday was it was at the highest level. And they don't even necessarily report on that much anymore. It's you'd have to I have to dig around and look at the numbers to figure out, oh, yeah, well, we just broke another record. And there's a good cause for it. The Institute for Supply Management's Manufacturing Index hit 60.8, which is a geeky way of saying that
we're growing
things
really, really fast.
Anything over 50 is we're growing.
Yeah, there's an economics concept that isn't part of reality. So let's get ready for this.
Really?
50 represents neutrality. It represents this neutral state that isn't real. So they kind of reset it.
You mean not kind of like Connecticut?
Well, it's not a neutral state. That's a liberal state.
Oh, okay.
So if Connecticut were neutral, it wouldn't
be
real. Yeah. But it's a state of equilibrium, and that's the term used in economics. And it's kind of like using a steady state in physics. Well, this is a state at rest. Well, that doesn't exist. So we have this measurement of the economy that changes if we have exactly the same numbers that we had last quarter or last month, then that equals 50. We're not going up. We're not going down. We're at 60, which is
good.
Really good.
And it is the highest level it's been in 13 years, which is even better. I mean, in other words, basically what we're seeing in the manufacturing and in the service sector, but more in the manufacturing sector, is the orders are coming in, the backlogs are building up, they're wanting to hire more people because they've got more things to do. And I don't know whether we reported it on the radio program last week, but it was definitely in the newsletter. Capital investing by manufacturing companies is pretty stout. It's up and growing. Because they're seeing manufacturing companies in the United States are seeing increased orders, increased busyness. Some of this, by the way, and we're going to get to the jobs report in a minute, but some of this, by the way, is because of exactly the same factor that caused us to have 33,000 fewer people working in September than worked in August, which is that there were a couple of 3 or 5 or 12 or however many hurricanes.
Yeah, yeah.
And every time the hurricanes go in and destroy stuff, At some point, we have to rebuild the stuff. Well, we generally do, whether we should or not.
Right.
Rebuild the stuff that the hurricane destroyed, and that means a lot of manufactured stuff needs to be created to rebuild the stuff. Stuff is a economics term. You know,
there's some specifics here in that the automobile manufacturers are getting orders out their ears, which is
That's a terrible thing.
Statistically, it's a dangerous thing to have orders coming out of your ears.
Is that like over 50 is out your ears?
I would suppose so. That's directly related to water damage to engines of cars. The number of cars that were underwater in Houston and in Florida.
And are about to be underwater in New Orleans.
And that's going to hit. So we talked about this when the hurricanes hit. We're going to have a hit to GDP this quarter.
Yeah.
Next quarter, we're likely to have a really big boom in the GDP numbers because of the efforts to purchase back things that were
replace all the cars.
Broken. Now, it won't be a big boon to the insurance companies.
Well,
but
the insurance companies actually had enough reserves because they had Katrina kind of gave them the shock.
Yes.
But it's interesting. You would think that, okay, all those houses were destroyed, so the insurance companies should be in deep trouble. No,
they're not.
They don't cover floods.
Yeah, and they look like they're on track to be profitable this quarter.
But they do cover cars that get flooded.
Yes.
And I've actually tried to contact...
And they cover roof damage, and they cover trees falling on roofs and trees falling on cars, and they cover... things being blown through windows and things like that.
But the biggest loss for the insurance companies, at least according to what I've been reading in these hurricanes, is going to be automobiles, far larger than property damage for the rest of the houses. Most of the damage on the houses and so on, they can say, oh, well, that was flood, and they don't cover flood. But I guess they would, you know, if you got hailed on while the wind was blowing, your roof might need replacing. But that's not the rest of the – you've got to replace the rest of the house first.
So roof damage is going to be covered in a lot of cases. Car damage is almost always going to be covered unless somebody just had pure liability protection instead of their own car coverage.
A lot of cars. That's really a lot of cars in the Houston area, for example, were – semi-submerged or submerged, and they across the board from what I've been reading and listening to people about, they just if the water got up and got up into the passenger compartment, then they total the car because it stinks. The end result is a lot of cars will be going to Mexico because they still run. B, there'll be a lot of record-breaking automobile sales. By the way, the people are buying almost exclusively SUVs and pickups.
Yes. I want to cover that.
Even if their sedan was the one that was destroyed.
Right.
They're buying SUVs, which might have something to do with all the branches down and the fact that driving through high water has become a priority.
Right. But there's another piece to it. And that is I'm going to cover some sounds like completely unrelated news.
Good.
But it's the same news.
Oh.
Okay, so...
Unrelated, identical news.
Yes. In 2015, traffic fatalities, automobile fatalities, rose 8% in the United States.
After falling for many years.
Right. And then in 2016, so last year, it rose 5.6%. So those are two big increases, one year after another. Yeah. And the manufacturers and the automobile safety associations are all saying, how is this? What is this? Are people forgetting to wear their seatbelts? Are the airbags not working? No, gas is cheaper.
That gas is cheaper. And
that's the big one.
And they're driving little bitty cars.
Right. So they bought little bitty cars when gas was expensive. Now gas is cheap and they're driving a lot more and we're having traffic fatalities. So it's the same thing with why SUVs are being purchased. When gasoline prices are low, people would prefer to have larger cars. This is the United States. We have further, particularly in Texas, we have a lot further to drive and we'd like to carry a lot of things. This isn't Denmark where you can drive for 10 minutes and get to the other side of the country.
I did read a study that strongly suggests that a large portion of the rise in traffic fatalities per 100,000 miles, not just rise in fatalities, but per million miles or whatever, is a result of the cell phone. people texting.
Right. Well, in our last legislative session here in Texas, they said, stop texting, stop talking on the phone, or you're going to get a ticket while you're driving. So keep that in mind.
Can you technically still text on the phone while driving in
no,
Texas?
No, not anymore. Well, you can technically do it, but it's illegal.
Oh, you can't even talk on the phone?
You're not supposed to. You're allowed to hold the phone while looking at a map on the phone, but you're not allowed to hold the phone while talking to someone or texting someone.
Which is a generational difference, because back in my time...
Hold the phone means something completely different. Wait, hold the phone.
Put it on hold, yes.
Now it just means put it in your other hand.
Well, there's some other market-related stuff.
Let me give that final statistic. The number of people that died on the roads last year in the United States. This is something...
How many people died?
I don't want to downplay tragedies when they happen, because tragedies are tragedies. We're talking about 58 people died in Las Vegas, and there's all these actions going forward to say, how can we stop this from happening again? And I agree with that wholeheartedly. We got to figure out some method of finding out who these people are before they do it. Sometimes it's going to be impossible. But the difference between that number and last year, we killed 37,461 people on the road. And the only solution to that is self-driving cars, and that's coming. And at some point, our kids and grandkids are going to say, how many people died on the road? And you just got in the car, and you weren't afraid when you got in the car, and did you know people that died? And we'll say, yes, as most people know someone that has died in an automobile accident. And our kids and grandkids will go, wow, you were very adventurous. And we just say, no, that was just life.
It's one of those things that I think is odd, that if there's a small airplane that crashes in, let's say, California or Alaska or something, three people get killed, it makes national news.
A car pileup with 10 people in it.
Yeah, 10 people getting killed in a big traffic accident, and it may not even make the local news.
Well, it's going to be in the obituaries somewhere way back in the back.
It might be. It might not
be. When their funerals come up.
Depends on, but they might be scattered across. But you don't see that, you know, we
report news that's unusual. And right now, traffic fatalities are not unusual. That's a sad place to be. And hopefully we won't be there later.
And I must admit, that's one of the things that causes me to drive a 3/4 ton pickup with a big steel brush guard on the front end.
So what you're saying is, if there's a fatality, it isn't going to be you, or properly speaking, it ain't going to be you.
Unless, of course, it's an 18-wheeler I run into, in which case I'm out of luck.
Right.
But fundamentally, you're going to have to be driving something really big to kill me. And I feel like, quite justifiably, my highest probability of death, other than from natural causes, is from somebody running into me, or me running into somebody who pulls out in front of me.
Right.
And I'm a sufficient coward that I basically drive a tank.
Without a turret. You need a turret. If you're going to call it a tank, you need a turret.
Not necessarily. The Swedish S-Tank did not have a turret. It was a very efficient tank.
I would say your vehicle is more efficient on the roads than
a Swedish S-Tank?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but the Swedish S-Tank was a tank, but didn't have a turret. So you don't have to have a turret to have a thing. Anyway, let's see what else happened. The U.S. Treasury note was yielding 2.366, which is a lot more than it was yielding a year ago, but a lot less than any reasonable person would think it would yield. 10 years, basically, you can, the United States government can borrow money at 2.366%, which is likely to be at or below the inflation rate. And I realize that we haven't got inflation up to 2% yet, but given 10 years, given some other things that maybe we'll talk about, the tax reform, if it were to pass, there's a probability that inflation will gradually creep back up towards 3%. And the government is capable of going out and borrowing money at 2.366% right now, which is astonishingly low, and is one of the, it's kind of like inflation, which is running about 1.4, 1.7% per year. It's one of those things that economists are debating vigorously, and I really haven't read anything that suggests that they know why this is happening. And I love it. I saw an article that said by a former governor of the Federal Reserve, and he said the Federal Reserve nor anyone else has any reliable methodology for predicting inflation at this point. So that's all there. Now, gold prices dropped again. Normally, when we see hurricanes and disasters and cataclysms and earthquakes, and we've seen all of that in the recent past, gold prices tend to rise. In fact, they dropped. They were down 0.38% for the week. For the last month, down 5.43%. And this is an interesting thing. We used to think of gold as a good place to store your money in case of a cataclysm or disaster or something.
And some people still do think of it that way.
And people think of it that way. But the fact is, every time we have a natural disaster or an economic crisis, the price of gold drops, which, folks, is perfectly rational, because that means that the people, for instance, in Houston who needed money sold their gold. I'm not saying that I have evidence that somebody in Houston sold their gold, but in Mexico City, which is where they had an earthquake, there is an indication that we're seeing increased gold selling in the Western Hemisphere associated with these crises. And we saw some significant gold selling that went on in 2009 in the middle of the financial crisis.
Yeah, one of the things about something we've known about Puerto Rico for a while is that there have been a lot of gold purchases taking place in Puerto Rico as people have been afraid of the banks because Puerto Rico is having financial problems. Now, the banks are FDIC insured, but people are not necessarily rational when they think about this sort of stuff. So a lot of gold was purchased, and a lot of that gold is being sold right now because they need money.
And
that's causing the price of gold to drop, which means that they didn't preserve their assets for the disaster. They made their assets less for the disaster.
There was an argument a few years ago, particularly on Fox, with some people who are no longer there, making the argument that if the dollar collapses, you need to have gold. Well, the problem is you got to sell the gold for dollars before you can buy anything.
Yeah, well, it's one of those hard things to do at the grocery store is try to buy with gold coins or a gold bar.
Right. It doesn't work particularly well. And even if it did, you would soon have people visiting your house.
Yes.
To remove the gold because it was obviously encumbered your life. So gold prices dropped, and there's one of the things that is very, very real is that gold has not, over the past 20 years or so, behaved the way the myth suggests it would behave. And it's probably a very poor place to store your money at this point. I would suspect it's a poor place to store it, particularly as interest rates start to come back up again. And I do think in the next year we're going to see interest rates start to rise. People are going to start selling gold and moving their money into higher paying interest positions. And at that point, I think we could see the price of gold continue to fall. I don't know. I mean, nobody's been able to predict the price of gold very well historically, so I'm not going to jump in there. I just think that there's a fundamental issue with gold, and that is it does not produce value. If you buy...
Unless you're a jeweler. If you're a jeweler or you work with electronics, you can produce value from
gold. No, but it doesn't. You can produce value from gold, but gold doesn't produce value
right by
itself.
Setting it down somewhere and saying, do something.
Whereas as opposed to storing your money, saving money, if you invest it in something that actually is producing things of value and you're patient and you have enough diversification, historically what we've seen is that things that produce value actually are creating wealth, creating money in the company or whatever, and that money then tends to flow back to the owners over time. Now, it doesn't happen in every case. That's why we say diversify. But on average, it does happen that way, and with gold, it's the other way around. It costs you money to hold gold one way or another. Anyway, that's what's going on in the markets. The stock markets continue to rise. They continue to rise for a very, very good reason, and that is because the underlying economy is showing very, very strong signs of continuing to grow at least over the next 6 months. That's about as far in advance as we can see what's going on in the economy. tremendous service. The Institute for Supply Management Service Index also went up, despite the fact, by the way, and this is what I found fascinating, the job losses that we had, the 33,000 fewer workers as unemployment dropped 4.2%.
Yeah. Let's explain that a second.
Okay.
Because we have unemployment dropped to 4.2% from 4.4. At the same time, we had 33,000 fewer workers.
But they were in bars, grills, and restaurants, mainly in the places where the hurricane hit.
Right. And the reason is that percentage number, the unemployment number, is done on a household survey. They call people up and they say, do you have a job? And they say, yes or no.
Are you looking for a job?
Are you looking for a job? No. Well, people that are affected by a hurricane won't be looking for a job and still consider themselves to have a job.
But they're not actually working.
They just can't go to the job.
Yeah.
And that's the number that we see with the 33,000 not working.
And 4.2%, by the way, is about as close as we ever get. Because it was 2001, as the economy was... People were still employed, but the economy collapse had not, or the economy downturn of the following 2000 had not yet impacted employment. We hit pretty much a peak in 2001 of 4.2% unemployed, and from there it was all downhill, you know, with higher unemployment. And we're at 4.2%. We are in effect at full employment right now.
Yeah, we could go lower. I mean, we could have more people hired, but
it's really hard.
It's really, really hard. There aren't, I mean, what you see with that 4.2%, that's people going from one job to another in large part. Resignation versus layoff or firing, resignation is much higher as a percentage of the people out of work right now than being laid off or being fired. And that means that you generally resign when you know you have another thing or you think you can get another thing quickly.
Yeah, if you break down the numbers from the Labor Department on the unemployment, you discover that about 27%, about a quarter of that 4%, about 1% of the working of the people who want to work. We might need to close the door there. We're getting loud noises. About 1% of the people who want a job and can't find a job have been unemployed long enough that they're considered long-term unemployed. So you've got about 1% of the people out there who just flat, who would like to have a job, but for instance, let's just say they're an auto worker and they live in Detroit and there's no new need for auto workers because they've been replaced by a robot.
Or a union worker that does something specific. Mm-hmm. And that's the only thing they want to get hired for. And they're not changing their mind. This is the only thing I want to get hired for. And that job isn't really available in their location anymore.
And we've talked about this before, but there's a pretty good sized chunk, unusually large chunk of the working age male population that are not working, are not looking for work. So we have a workforce participation rate of about 60%. It's been much higher at various times. About, and this is amazing to me to look at the numbers, somewhere between 11 and 12% of the white, now this is an interesting thing, mostly white male working age population consider themselves to be disabled and unable to work. Some of that, and I read different numbers, but a significant part of that are people who are addicted to pain medications and can't get a job because A, they're in pain, and B, they fail the test for drugs because they're taking pain medication.
Right, or they are unable to function properly because they're on pain medication. We mentioned this last week. The heavy equipment can't be used. If you come in and you're working at a construction site, which is a good place to get hurt enough that you need pain medications to get hooked on, you may have completely lost your job forever if you're hooked on these prescribed by somebody who's supposed to know the...
Even if you're not hooked, if you're just taking them.
Yeah, you can't go to work. You can't operate a backhoe or any of the big construction. You can't certainly work on a high-rise. Well,
there's a lot of discussion about the fact that our participation rate is lower than it used to be. Well, sure, because 20 years ago, People who came to a construction site were typically not being tested to see if they're on opioid medication.
Right.
They are now. Why are they tested now? Because they could wind up hurting themselves or others and suing their employer if they didn't get a test.
The last piece of this is the number of early retirees on Social Security. People that are 62 years old and take early retirement, it's a choice they've made. They fall within the numbers, so the numbers go from 25 to 65.
Yeah.
Anybody, and there's a big demographic bulge called the baby boom going through that process right now, and anybody that retires early looks like they are not participating in the workforce.
Well, that's because they're not.
They're not participating in the workforce. So they've earned it. They get the right to do that. And even if they retire early and they say, I'd like to go back to work, they often are discouraged from going back to work by realizing that they're going to lose their Social Security check in that month if they make too much more than what they're already getting paid. And
so there's a tremendous disincentive to go to work.
Yeah, and let me say this to people out there. If there is anybody out there age 62 or between 62 and 67, and you've got Social Security coming in and you retired early. Say you're in a skilled profession and somebody offers you a $90,000 a year job, but you realize that you're going to lose your Social Security that year, which early retirement means that you're probably getting paid somewhere between $20,000 and $30,000 from Social Security. Take the $90,000 job, even if you lose the $20,000 or $30,000, because you've netted out $60,000 or $70,000 on the process. It's just really, really hard.
All depends on whether they really want the $60,000 or $70,000. If they would be willing to be paid $60,000 or $70,000 to do that rather than be retired.
Exactly. And then the question is, do I want to work extra years at $60,000 or $70,000? And if you say that's not enough, then keep doing your early retirement and don't worry about it. But other people say, well, I really would like to make more money, but I don't want to lose the Social Security. On the whole, it's a good trade.
Well, it all depends on whether you want to work or not.
Yeah. If you don't want to work, then that makes it easy. Yeah, that unparticipation, that's what that is.
So what we're seeing in the economy continues to be a lot of underlying health and very slow growth. I mean, when I say very slow growth, it's
3.1%.
Well, that was the one quarter.
One quarter.
And it was 1.2% before that. And I think we're going to see maybe 2.3%
for the year.
For this quarter that just ended.
Yeah, I think
for the quarter that just ended.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good average for the year.
Maybe a little lower because of the hurricane. So we'll see. You know, we used to run 3 to 4% GDP coming out of a recession. We just haven't done it. And one of the reasons this thing is running, this recovery is now the third longest in the history since we've been keeping records on such things, is because it is so slow. It's kind of like, it's very much related to the market. Where if by Tuesday we don't have a 5% drop in the S&P 500, and I really don't see one coming, this will be the longest run we're about to see of the S&P 500 without a 5% drop. We'll start breaking records beginning Wednesday.
Now, before you get too nervous about that, saying, oh, that means we're due for a downturn, it's also one of the slowest, longest-running rises. It's just been rising very slowly, very steadily,
very
consistently for a long time. And part of that, I'm glad we're talking about this. This is one of the areas that I wanted to break in. There's something called, I love that economists have these technical words and then they out of the blue come up with something like animal spirits.
Oh, I love animal spirits.
Animal spirits. We need to revive our animal spirits. Animal spirits is literally a technical term.
We should have a brand of whiskey called animal spirits.
Yeah, it's spirits made from animals.
Just animal spirits.
Distilled animals.
Because it brings out the animal spirit single malt Scotch whiskey.
Yeah. So the idea here is that we have done some things. This is something we do it in sports. We do it in almost anything that we have the ability to make rules in. If we look at sports, this is a great segue here.
I don't.
we don't look at sports very much, but we both saw or read Moneyball. I actually know some of the people that are conglomerated into single characters in Moneyball from school and from being colleagues. So this idea that what you do is you take the statistics and you make a perfect team, but you don't have any of the outliers in there. You don't have a Babe Ruth. You don't have somebody that's going to knock the ball out of the park consistently, but you have a winning team. And what that's done is it's increased the length of the baseball games and made them more boring because you don't have the big plays. If everybody plays Moneyball, then what we'll have is very long, very boring, but statistically improved games. And that's what we're seeing in the market.
Right.
We have a lot of regulatory reform that has put a lot of restriction on the ability to leap forward and do amazing things. Banks
also
have
the
to have
ability to blow the system up.
Right. Also the ability to blow the system up. So as long as the headline in baseball was about the record-breaking number of home runs, and those still exist occasionally, then the impetus was there for steroids, and then the breaking of the system is on the other side, because the need to break out of the box and do better so that you can be hired by another team was really, really strong. And so we had the steroids crisis. Our response to that was Moneyball. Let's look at the statistics and find the statistically the best team, and we'll just win on the statistics instead of the big plays. And what they're finding in the market and in baseball is it creates this doldrum effect of we're limited, we're not going to break ourselves. As a population ages, we tend to do this. If you look at Northern Europe, it's an aging population, or you look at Japan, it's an aging population. And as the population gets older, they put more and more restrictions on the breakaway things, the things that might make or break in a short period of time. There's more restrictions on them. You see less of it. The history of the American economy is full of people that are willing to bust their noses repeatedly, get back up and keep going. When we have restrictions against busting your nose, even your own nose, then we get some slower growth. Elon Musk is an example of that. PayPal is an example of coming out with something completely new. It's really hard to form a new banking institution that's not a banking institution anymore because of regulations. If the regulations of today existed, PayPal would not have been made. And that, so what we're doing is we're making things safer, but also making things slower.
And speaking of slower, it's time for commercials. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. Telephone number in here, if today is October 7th, is 254-773-1400. But we really need to take – KTM wants us to take a break and play some stuff for you to listen to before we come back.
So we'll be back on the other side. If you'd like to join us, it's 254-773-1400, and we'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. We got it right.
Well, we can say our names. We are very proud
of
ourselves.
Being able to say them in synchronous order together, in synchronicity, that's...
It's still probably not that impressive to anyone but us.
And what is impressive to me, let me tell you. Let's see what else is going on across the world. What's the threats to the economy?
I would say the thing that's kind of people have been screaming about for so long that people are ignoring the screaming is that interest rates are low, bond prices are high, and we're still seeing more money going into bonds.
Oh, well, that's a threat to individual investors, and I want to talk about that specifically, maybe about the Puerto Rican situation. But there is a risk, and that is right now supplies are tight. What we're seeing is greater backlogs in the manufacturing sector because the availability of raw materials and parts from overseas is still a bit limited. The Port of Houston shut down for a while, and that's a major port. It's theoretically back up again, but it's not at full strength. And very frankly, the United States Chamber of Commerce issued a warning this week about the NAFTA negotiations, that the U.S. getting excessively tough on the NAFTA negotiations could be very seriously damaging to the United States economy. If, for example, at least according to the United States Chamber of Commerce, if the president were to direct his NAFTA negotiators to not budge from their position that they've taken and say basically, okay, we're going to pull out of NAFTA because it's not good enough for us, which is, by the way, the position they took last week, it would severely hinder and damage the manufacturing sector of our economy, because we import a tremendous number of subcomponents when we manufacture something, and we import a lot of raw materials. And if, very frankly, that's a threat. I'm not saying that politically one way or the other, but I'm simply saying that the threats to pull out of NAFTA have got manufacturers and the Chamber of Commerce scared. Really scared, and that's a real threat.
Let me explain that a second, and let's talk about a company, a single company, and it could be any company that does manufacturing in the United States, but I'll use Ford kind of as a hypothetical, because people know what Ford is. Not recommending Ford, this isn't even accurate about Ford, but as a concept, they get
We're talking about Ford Motor Company.
Right, Ford Motor Company. They get raw material, the iron ore. It's refined. It's turned into steel, and Ford buys a bunch of it. It's sent down to Mexico. Mexico, a company there, owned by Ford or part of Ford or contracted with Ford, doesn't buy that steel. Ford bought the steel. Ford then pays the factory workers to make that part, whatever that part is, out of the metal, out of the steel. So then the part comes back to the United States. It never changed ownership. We call it an export of raw material and an import of a finished part, but the ownership never changed. So export-import is almost irrelevant. It was still owned by the same manufacturer. Then it's brought to a plant somewhere, and sometimes it's in Mexico, sometimes it's in the United States, sometimes it's in Canada. So we'll go to the extreme and say this part then leaves Mexico and heads up to Canada, where it's put into a vehicle that now runs. That vehicle is now shipped down to Houston and sold to as a new purchase to someone in Houston. Who made the money on this? Well, there were some factory workers in Mexico and in Canada.
And in the United States.
And in the United States that got paid for this. But the vast majority of the profit goes to an American-based company. So how is getting out of NAFTA going to affect that? Well, every time the raw material crosses a border, turns into something else, there are the opportunities for tariffs. And this is where tariffs, not terrorists or tourists, tariffs. And when there's a tariff, it makes the price of whatever's going across go up for the end consumer. So an American company, by moving the product around to get the best price for the consumer, the price goes up either because they have to do all the manufacturing in the United States and American workers cost more. And they're going to cost even more if we try to hire a bunch of factory workers when we have a 4.2% unemployment rate. There aren't enough workers.
Well, there's actually been, and I've read some really good articles by economists who have some excellent track records, that if we got rid of NAFTA at this point or dramatically changed it to reduce imports, raise costs of imports,
right,
it would cause a large-scale unemployment in the United States.
Yeah, and that's the end result that usually happens
here. Because I've had people say, well, just bring those jobs in Mexico and Canada back to the United States. Well, the problem is there's a lot of problems with it, but the biggest single problem is, A, we don't have enough workers. B, if you brought them back to the United States, the price of that automobile or pickup truck or whatever
goes up by a third.
It would go up by at least a third, and some people have said it would double, and I think the double may be closer to it because it would be a shortage.
Which will mean less people will buy the car, mm-hmm. which means we have to lay off the workers at the new plant.
Yeah, we'll be basically be in a position where we sell fewer vehicles. We sell fewer anythings because the price would go up, and this would cause inflation to rise because the prices would go up. And as inflation rose, then the Federal Reserve would have to increase interest rates, which would make everything more expensive. And they are saying that the promised termination of NAFTA would almost certainly create a recession and a massive drop in the stock market.
Yeah, and this goes beyond free trade. So people that have listened to us for a long time know that we are proponents of free trade. We think the more free trade we have, the better the American system is going to work because we're the best at it. Even if we weren't talking about free trade, even if we just take that completely off the table for the conversation and just looked at existing infrastructure, this is part of the reason why we're against a complete repeal of the Affordable Care Act. Just out of the blue, complete repeal without anything to replace it. Because the infrastructure's already in place. The rule book already says these are the ways that you have to design an insurance product. When we're talking about NAFTA, this is the most cost-effective way of designing an automobile or anything else that's for sale. All of that has to be rewritten. If there's not a good period of time leading up to the change, then the American companies that are trying to maintain profitability have to, in the case of NAFTA, have to somehow come up with the ability to make the parts here. And that's expensive because they have to retool or completely recreate a plant to do the thing that they already have a plant doing. You can see the infrastructure problems, and part of the reason this is it takes a long time to steer the Titanic. We're a lot bigger than the Titanic. Anytime we do a from the gut quick move when we're talking about the infrastructure of manufacturing and all trade as it exists, you better give that some lead time. If you don't give it a lead time, expect a recession, a major one, because the manufacturers will not be able to cope. Their profits will drop faster than they can create new plants.
The article I read had an interesting point of irony. It would be the American-based manufacturers that would be hit the hardest.
Right.
Companies like Nissan and Kia, yeah, they would be conceivably hit because they're importing. But the point is, we don't have a free trade agreement with Japan.
Nope.
And we don't have a free trade agreement with China. So what would happen is there would be no change in the cost, for example, of a Nissan being brought into the United States and sold. But anything that was manufactured partially in the United States, because of the way that we've globalized into Mexico and Canada, because frankly, there's just not enough workers in the United States to make a car in the United States.
Right.
The way we've globalized would mean that the American automobile industry would be hit with multiple tariffs as things cross borders, whereas Nissan gets hit with one. And
right.
What it would do, it would devastate, very frankly, it would devastate the American-based automobile manufacturers, and it would profit overseas automobile manufacturers that move vehicles directly into the United States.
Right. And there's a really good example of it that's just been in the process of happening this year. The new tariff on Canadian soft pulp lumber. So we used to buy a lot of lumber from Canada. It came across through NAFTA. The Trump administration looked at it and said it looks like it's getting subsidized. So through the NAFTA process, said, this is not right. We're putting a tariff on this. You violated NAFTA. They're doing the same thing with Bombardier right now. So Boeing lodged a complaint. Bombardier is going to have a thing, a large fine levied against it. It's going to make their planes more expensive. And the likelihood is that Airbus, not Boeing, is going to be the one that profits from this. They've got more manufacturing capacity at the moment. Boeing has filled up its manufacturing capacity. They've got everything filled up.
And the interesting thing is Boeing doesn't have any aircraft that competes with anything made by Bombardier, which
right.
is weird.
So Airbus in France is going to take advantage of our tiff with Canada. The soft pulp wood does not mean suddenly American lumber companies are making huge amounts of money. No, in fact, we're making up the difference by buying from Russia and China. Those are two places that we already had tariffs on. They already had their prices set up that way. Our Russian imports of lumber, by the way, the birch, the high-quality lumber, are some of the things that we put the sanctions on the Russians on, but we didn't put sanctions on the soft pulp wood lumber because they weren't selling a lot of it. So now suddenly we're buying a lot of lumber from Russia, who's in the habit of invading their neighbors, because we're upset over a minuscule subsidy that the Canadians put on. And the Canadians are our friends.
The Canadians, by the way, the subsidy is that the Canadian government owns the land.
Yeah.
On which this lumber is being cut.
And they're not charging market prices for the lease.
Like the U.S. Forest Service.
Right.
Grazing. I hate to break this to you, but
we sell beef to Canada that's grazed on U.S. government land at extremely low lease prices.
Not only extremely low, but in some cases, no.
Right.
Remember the guy they tried to shut down and move his cattle off?
Yeah.
Because he wasn't paying his leases.
Bundy, yes.
He's still not paying his
and
leases.
He's still making profits on the cattle.
And he's still selling cattle.
So that's a subsidy. So what we're saying here is that, yes, it's important to make sure that people aren't violating the rules, but we need to do our own internal cleanup at the same time. And in the process of pointing a finger at another country, make sure that we're not so deeply committed to that other country in our trade that by shutting it off would hurt us more than it hurts them. And that's where we are right now with NAFTA. It would hurt us a lot. It wouldn't be more than it hurts Mexico or Canada, but it would hurt us a lot.
We're coming down to the end of the first hour, and I wanted to kind of summarize. First off, the markets were up generally over 1% this week, and they continue to rise based on good economic news, good economic forecasting. There's been some discussion about the optimism to do with the supposed tax reform process in Congress. We'll talk about that next hour. And the issue is that fundamentally the economy is doing well. The markets are up. Gold is down. Treasury securities are yielding about what they've been yielding. So there's an awful lot of things not happening out there, despite the fact that we've had cataclysms and disasters rolling in. Automobile sales are breaking records. We're not quite breaking records, but
getting
they're
close.
Way up there.
It's likely to start breaking records.
And
the records only go back to 2011 because people waited so long during the recession to buy their cars that they all bought them in 2011.
But you are listening to a couple of guys, Jeff and Jake, who are the principals at the Personal Wealth Coach, and we manage investments for people who have significant amount of money that they would like to have us manage. And you can reach us off the air if you'd like, either voicemail during the weekend or real live people, because we don't have a phone tree during the week. And it's at 254-947-1111.
You can reach that toll free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email us at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. That's the Personal Wealth Coach. You can go to our webpage, that same address. You can listen to our podcasts, read our newsletter. Until next hour.
KTEM AM 1400, the voice of Central Texas, Temple, Belton, Killeen.